You're listening to World Oil Deep Dive, conversations with energy industry leaders and engineers about the market trends and technologies shaping the oil and gas industry. Now, here's this week's episode.
All right, everybody, welcome back. This is a really special episode because we're here at the PF Holdings offices, and we have as our guest today, Matt Wilks, the executive chairman of PF Holdings. Matt, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, it's exciting to be up here. Before we get into talking about business and the markets and all of that stuff, why don't you give us a little bit of background? So you were CFO, then president, then executive chairman. I mean, how did all that come about?
So in 2016, prior to 2016, we thought we'd be able to go in and buy a bunch of horsepower for pennies on the dollar. And we probably touched about 7 million horsepower, and it was all junk. We felt like it was junk. There's no way anybody's going to spend money to bring this stuff back to life. And, you know, what? Of course, that ended up not being the case. There's, I guess, in some situations, if there's enough capital, then they'll throw it at anything.
Right.
And so we were able to go in and identify a bunch of these targets. So early on, I was setting a lot of this up, knowing that we were going to start a frac company. And, of course, we didn't end up, you know, getting to buy very much at all. We ended up just going down the lane of new builds, building all of our own equipment. And all through that process, I was involved. And eventually, once it got off and running, I came over to help button up a few things and ended up as CFO, which is fine with me. I like finance. I'm not so much accounting.
Right. No, my wife's CFO at our company, so I know the difference for sure.
And so it was interesting. I've always been involved in business, and historically it was, you know, as a bricklayer in a masonry business, and learned coming up through the family business on, you know, what your three financial statements, you know, mean and what activity in the field actually translates into activity on your financial statements, and being able to bridge those two disciplines, you know, turns out in business, it's not something that you see very often.
Right.
But it just kind of natural. So just moved through the organization and was whatever the company needed, that's what it was.
Now, when you were setting that up, Lad, your brother, right? He's cousin. He was CEO the whole time, like from the beginning? I mean, because you were all there at the founding, right? I mean, you guys all put it together.
So starting out, we were just representing the family. We didn't have titles.
Ah, okay.
And it wasn't until, late 2017 before I became CFO and he was CEO.
Ah, okay. And then you just skipped over him to, president after the CFO thing. That's a natural step for a CFO to be president, but then jumped to the, you know, executive chairman. And what was that change like for you? I mean, why was that important for you to get that executive chair?
Oh, well, I mean, my experience has always been so after we sold FracTech, I set up our family office. And so my exposure to the capital markets and the public markets in whole just made it an easy transition. I had more experience there. And then on the deal making side with the overall vision and roadmap that I'd put together, it just made sense for me to be the executive chair.
Yeah. And so that decision, like you were saying, the decision not to go with used equipment and to kind of build out your own solution, is that kind of what led to the development of PF Holdings and all the companies in PF Holdings? Was that always part of the roadmap when you said, oh, we're not buying that stuff that's out there, we're going to do our own?
When we started FracTech back in 2001, we started out as a manufacturer.
Oh, okay.
And it was because we couldn't get our own equipment. Nobody would sell us equipment. It was going to be like 18 months before we could get it. And so we was like, how hard can this be? So we ended up going in and building our own equipment back then. We already had experience in running manufacturing operations. And so, you know, for us to come in and just build our own stuff was no big deal.
Yeah, that was a no-brainer. And so tell us then about PF Holdings and all of the companies, five companies under there now, right? So how did that come about? How did that growth happen?
So it's just all the vertical integration and our focus on it. We want to get our hands around as much of the value chain and participate in as much of that value chain as we can. And so we went in and started picking off, you know, opportunities that would allow us to expand. So we already had a sand mine with Wilks Brothers that made sense for us to bring this in pre-IPO. And then with Best Flow, prior to us even, you know, starting ProFrac, we bought Best Flow, which was a flowback iron business that was expanding into high pressure iron. We acquired it early in 2016 and started scaling up its fluid end manufacturing, eventually got power ends, so on and so forth. And so when we had these ingredients already put together, but they were not underneath ProFrac. And so as part of us going public, it made sense for us to gather up each of these verticals that we already had with the larger organization and put it underneath ProFrac Holdings. So when we started it, we wanted to separate holdings from ProFrac services so that we can focus on each of those verticals as independent, but a valuable part of a bigger family. And now that we're public, our entire strategy now is going in and highlighting the strength of each of those verticals and diversifying them across the overall space instead of just having a single customer.
Right, exactly, because that perfectly makes sense that, hey, ProFrac, we need to secure our own supply chain for all of these things that we're using all the time. But with all of those companies, I imagine there's a lot of market opportunities out there for each one of them individually, right?
Well, certainly. And, you know, having each of these businesses isolated and segmented appropriately is certainly a focus that we have. Not only does it reduce your overall cost structure being vertically integrated, but each of those verticals standing on their own gives you the ability to go in and make sure that each of the some of the parts are trading relative to their peer class.
Right, yeah.
Where manufacturing businesses trade differently, sand businesses trade differently, and service companies certainly trade differently than the rest of the market.
Yeah, no, it's amazing structure, you know, you put together and having all of that. I'm excited to see, you know, some of these offerings that, you know, I mean, like, let's talk about EKU for a second. I mean, they've always been selling outside, right? You were a big customer for them, but they've always been selling outside. But to really push that and to make it a bigger part of, you know, what ProFrac Holdings has to offer, I mean, that's going to be great for you guys.
Yeah, those guys are great. Just the overall team over there, they're just phenomenal. EKU, what they do is the idle management.
Right.
But they're also with the idle management, they have their control boxes and their knowledge overall of how the engines work, how the overall drivetrain is working together. It's just been incredible. Recently, they developed some automation for the entire frac fleet.
Oh, nice.
So that when we're running our frac fleets, we can go in and dial in exactly where the engine sweet spot is, the transmission sweet spot, the power end, to extend overall component life and to reduce the overall fuel consumption by running these things to perfection every time. And then even as far as the switching on gears with your transmission, the gear ratios on these transmissions, originally everything came out of the marine catalog. There wasn't an energy catalog.
Right, yep.
And way back in 2001, 2002, when we started FracTech, the engines, the transmission, it was a marine catalog. And so I don't know if it was tugboats or yachts or what, but the gear ratios on your transmission are geared for boats.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So that jump from first to second is really, really steep. And being able to go in and speed match, typically you're going to lose second gear before anything else if you have any transmission issues. And so being able to speed match between first and third gear is really important so you can keep on running that transmission because the cost of rebuilding it's the same whether you lost second or third or all of it. So you want to keep on running. So being able to speed match is important. What we found is that first and second is so far apart, it's just like skipping a gear anyway.
Ah, interesting, yeah.
And so speed matching is really important to make sure that you extend the life of that transmission.
Did you guys, I'm sorry because I just don't know, in there, do you guys have a transmission manufacturing as part of the portfolio yet?
We don't. We just do the rebuild.
Yeah, okay. So who do you use? Who do you use on your...
Typically, it's a twin disc or a CAT transmission.
Oh, yeah. Good idea. Let's go that way then. So EKU is also involved in your electric frac fleets, right?
They do quite a few things. So with, you know, they, of course, they do the controls. And that's why they've gotten into the automation. We actually have three companies that do controls, Iotech, EKU, and Petrix. Petrix does the in-house controls for frac equipment. But EKU has come in and really put some additional flavor to it to where that's where the automation has come in. That's how we come in. And a good way to think about it is your conscious mind is your Petrix. You know, what EKU does is the unconscious mind.
Oh, interesting.
Where you don't think about walking.
Right.
Or breathing. There's so many of these functions that are just kind of hardwired into you that you just know how to do. You know how to keep balance. You know how to do this stuff. And so that's what EKU is so great at. And so now we've got them working with us on the controls on the e-fleets, going in and looking at the harmonics, making sure that everything's working cleanly, that the resonance on the electric load. I don't know if any of these are actual terms, but these guys are great at making sure that I can say things in the wrong way and still sound like I know what I'm talking about.
No, it's true. There's a lot of things involved with that. We did a whole podcast series on oil field electrification. So it was 10 episodes, and I learned so much because those things like harmonics and frequency and feedback and stuff, that's an insane world that we're not used to, right? In oil and gas. I mean, you don't talk about those type of things at all. But tell us about the e-fleet. How's that going in the field?
It's going good. It's going good. The utilization rates are phenomenal. They're in line or better than what we see with our conventional fleets. And then, of course, you know, the fuel consumption is significantly lower. And then the overall operating costs are improved. But I'm not going to say so much in case any customers are listening. But no, it's just an excellent platform. This is the direction that the space is going to go. Just the fuel arbitrage alone, just insane.
It's significant, the cost savings. And also, you would think also in the maintenance things, like we were talking about transmissions and things that you just don't have to deal with, right?
Yeah, there's no oil changes. You still have your power end where you have lube changes on it, but there's no air filters, fuel filters, nothing like that. And so it's just really reliable. And it's still in the, you know, early stages on headcount and fleet optimization from that standpoint on how you set your crews up, really getting everything dialed in. Right now, we're at a spot where we overstaff just to make sure that everything is buttoned up and taken care of. But over time, this will turn into more of the crews staffed as a necessity rather than just a little bit of overkill.
Yeah.
Let me jump in here for a quick reminder. Be sure to join us for the Gulf Energy Information Excellence Awards on October 11, 2023 at the Post Oak Hotel in Houston, Texas. This premier black tie gala highlights advancements and leadership in the global energy industry. Network, celebrate, and register at gulfenergyinfo.com/events.
But no, it's quite interesting because, I mean, that market, it seemed like, I want to say 2 years ago, last year, because of all the talk of ESG and these things, it was really picking up, right? I mean, everybody and their brothers building electric frac fleets to put out there. And one of the things that came out of our oil field electrification podcast was that there's just not, you know, power sources for that. I mean, there's only so many ways you can get electricity to the field, right? And whether you're using a turbine or you're using diesel engines to generate electricity or tying in the grid. But that was an astonishing thing for me to learn was like, yeah, you know, if everybody builds what they say they're going to build, this is how many watts of electricity you need. And it's just not there.
Yeah, just going back a little bit, you know, your comment on the ESG, one of the things I like to say quite a bit is it's capitalism, not altruism.
Right.
That's why this has been embraced by the energy space. You know, bringing in these e-fleets, just about every advancement is driven by capitalism, not altruism. And some of these qualify for ESG, and so companies are going to raise their hand and take credit for that, but we're unapologetic about being capitalists.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's the only sustainable, you know, path forward, where it's just unnecessary jewelry that'll fall out in the next downturn. These are things that'll be here and working and thriving in downturns because it's capitalism.
Yeah. Well, that's funny that you say that because this was a big part of the discussion because ESG was such a hot topic last year. And, you know, I mean, it's obvious to anybody who's in the industry, yeah, ESG is great, but that's not the point, right? The point is cost savings, you know, all of that, more efficiency, all of that. And guess what? You know, if there's an ESG component to it, rock on, that's great. But it's the inverse, like you were saying, it's capitalism first, you know, ESG comes along for the ride, basically.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
My stakeholders and my fiduciary is to generate cash flow.
Absolutely.
But yeah, when you look at the distribution of power, it's really exciting for us because we love solving problems. And one of the things that we've realized throughout our careers in energy is that we're always solving problems that other industries are still working on. And so when we look at the distribution of power, it's 30 megawatts, 30 to, and if you get derated because it's hot or atmospheric pressure is low, you can have a turbine out there that's rated for 40 megawatts. And basically it's intermittent because these stages are only an hour and a half to 2 hours long. And so it's 30 megawatts and then none.
Right. And which is not great for a turbine, by the way. Yeah,
it's not. It's not. And so it introduces unique challenges that you've got to solve for. And it turns out that there's other industries that, you know, because of the grid, they didn't have to solve those.
Right, exactly.
But it removed solutions from the table because they didn't have a, you know, they weren't able to solve that problem. And so it's opening up some really interesting things. And so as we continue to move through and make these technologies work and solve some of these challenges, it's opening up some pretty interesting things. Like one of the things EKU is working on is they have a customer that has cranes and they want to be able to switch these cranes from running on generators or off the grid and to be able to make that switch seamlessly. And, you know, of course, with Winter Storm Uri coming, having come in, what was that, 2021? There's so many people that has gone out and gotten a Generac genset for their home.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And if you can go in and take a switch where you can switch, you know, these homes from the grid into that Generac genset seamlessly, but remotely, you can build massive virtual peaker plants.
Right, exactly.
By selling custody of that switch to your co-op or to the grid, there's really, really cool technologies that are coming out, you know, out of all of this that are solving unique, you know, situations and creating incredible value for all of society by giving us a more reliable grid.
Absolutely. So, Matt, you guys have an article coming up in the next issue of World Oil too, you know, talking about the electric grid and your work with Lifecycle, right?
Certainly. I think it highlights just how important it is just to have your infrastructure lined out. You know, having good partners that can come in and power your equipment, you know, that you can work with and solve unique challenges. There's a few solutions out there. We like what Lifecycle's doing. Pretty broad. They cover a lot of basins and pretty much go everywhere that we are at. And it's a good team over there.
Yeah, no, they're fantastic. They're fantastic. So now let's shift gears a little bit and talk about consolidation, you know, in the frack industry, right? I mean, so, I mean, you guys are a part of that because you're buying up things and, you know, putting them into the PF Holdings structure. But also we had that big news, what is that, 2 weeks ago now, NexTier and Universal Pressure Pumping. I mean, what's going on there? I mean, you got to have the pulse of the industry.
Yeah, I think consolidation is good all the way across. It comes with challenges. I like to look at different companies, like their, especially pressure pumpers, like their blood types.
Mm-hmm. Their blood types.
Yeah. You know, there's some blood types you can't donate to just anybody. And so you got to be real thoughtful and careful about your consolidation strategy and how that integration will go after the blood transfusion. And I think, you know, this business, this industry is just known for challenges on integration and, you know, just how timely. It can take some time. It's kind of, you know, pain in the butt. These aren't bolt-on businesses, and there's very few opportunities where you can go in and do that. That's one of the reasons that we think we can take, you know, blood from just about anybody because of our vertical integration. The three different companies that do controls for us, it means that we can integrate platforms, organize equipment based on configuration in, you know, individual basins, so that they can stay together. It makes integration a lot easier. But, you know, we're watching real close. I think that it'll be interesting to see how Patterson NexTier plays out. It looks like the only overlap that they had was on pressure pumping.
Yeah, it looks like that, yeah.
So we wish them the best and, you know, certainly happy to see somebody else participating and consolidating the space. It certainly needs it. Our philosophy on it is it's just supply and demand and the behavior. Consolidating doesn't necessarily take supply out of the market, but it affects the way that you manage that supply. I like using the sand market as an example. In West Texas, there's 21 mines, and it's probably changed by now just because somebody starting one up every Tuesday, it seems like. But of those 21 mines, there's 15 of them that are owned by a company that have more than one mine. So the other six are just singles. One company, they own one mine. And when you look across the cycle, the way that these companies behave is different than the guys with multiple assets. Because the guys with multiple assets will idle an asset and reduce their headcounts and right-size their business. And, you know, what I call is just they adjust supply, not price. The guys with one asset, they've got to keep the cash flow going. They'll go after utilization and diluting fixed costs and run full out and sell at whatever price they can to move the sand. Right. And so they're really bad actors in the market. So when you go in and you look at that from a consolidator's standpoint, it makes more sense to consolidate the single assets and leave the good behaving competitors in the market.
Right, yeah.
And cherry pick the assets you want based on geography and put together a better machine and leave the market in a better condition than you found it. And I think the same thing applies for the frac industry, just as a whole. When you look at how many players are in the market, what is their behavior if you leave them? What's, how is everyone else's behavior going to, going to be if I acquire this one over this one? And if you take that philosophy and look at what you're actually acquiring, it's more than just assets. You're acquiring a part of the market. And which part of the market do I want to be left as a minority owner of?
Right.
And so it's not always just going after the best asset or going after the best this. It's I'm buying a part of the overall market.
Well, when you see, and I'm just thinking about the next tier, Patterson deal, that was definitely a strong move for both of them, right? Because independently, they weren't in the top three. And now I think together, they'll be number two, right? So that's a strong consolidation. I mean, they're just on the heels of Halliburton, right? They're right behind Halliburton now.
Halliburton's at 52. They're at 46. We're at 45.
That's a tight top three, right? I mean, that's impressive, right?
It is. We could wake up on a Tuesday and have 47. But no, I think it's important that scale is important, but our goal is not to be the biggest. It's just to be the best and to focus on just the basics of the business and to go that extra distance and make sure that your customers have a good experience and appreciate what you're doing, that you always provide top service. But, also look at the overall market and make sure that you've got a healthy space. Most of the opportunities that we've had to consolidate were created from, just companies that weren't positioned for the cycle or that didn't know how to price their work. The opportunities will come and they'll present themselves, and being positioned to go after it is important.
It's like you read my outline here, Matt, because that's what I wanted to talk about next anyway, was the whole, what's next, man? What are you guys looking at now? If you want to drop names of companies, that would be nice for my portfolio, but
Well, I think one of the things is just we're focused really on ProFrac right now, more the holdings level. So with our vertical integration, we don't have all of our manufacturing businesses segmented out with our financials. And that's something that we're going to be really focusing on, making sure that each of these verticals are properly represented and their best foot is put forward. For example, underneath ProFrac services, we have a manufacturing business where we do our OEM, all of our repair work, and then, all of our supply chain management for the service business. And so, as we look forward, we're evaluating what it looks like having all of our manufacturing businesses together in one vehicle.
All right. Okay.
Because we like what our manufacturing peers look like. Want to go in and isolate that business so that it's easier to comp them against those peers. Really excited about that piece because it's, when we look at which parts of our overall family of companies really have good opportunities, in the long term. At some point, we're going to spill over from just simple scale. We'll spill over into the international markets. And so which of these businesses spill over well? Service businesses are really difficult to scale internationally because there's so many things that we're spoiled here in North America with. Like if you needed a $10 bolt or if you needed some oxygen or something for just a welded component. I mean, nobody thinks about not having some of the basics. But when you get into the international market, you may have to air freight something in and then it gets stuck in customs. Meanwhile, you're waiting, you know, 10 days to generate revenue because a $10 part or something that you just take for granted that you can just run down to the shop or to a store here and it's waiting for you. And so when you look at the manufacturing and the leasing side of the business, it's the easiest way to really make that jump and go international.
Yeah, ripe for expansion, yeah.
We're not currently evaluating anything, but our philosophy has always been around positioning ourselves so that those natural steps feel natural.
Right, yeah. Not try to force it, but just, hey, you know, we have this capacity. People want what we have. Let's ship it to them, that type of thing, as opposed to, like you said, setting up services overseas is a nightmare. I mean, that's a real, real big step. That's huge.
The companies that are most successful with it are not actually service businesses. They're manufacturing businesses. And the service businesses that are successful at it, they go about it as more of a manufacturing approach.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't realize that.
And so with all that being said, we're looking at the overall business structure, the business model of our manufacturing. And right now with our, for example, our lease business, we have one customer, is ProFrac Services, where manufacturing owns all the equipment and leases it to services. But many of our contracts have a structure that with the end customer, with the operator, that would allow us to go in and give us customer diversification for that manufacturing and leasing business. And what's great about it is it's the safest cash flows in our business because it's tied directly to the equipment and the counterparty is direct to the operator and they're secured by long-term contracts. And so going that approach and having the service business operate and take all the operational liability on that end is already something that we do, but there's no reason that we shouldn't carve out that lease revenue and the maintenance revenue so that we can put our best foot forward as a manufacturing business.
And so that'll be number six then in the pile, right? You break that out as a separate entity.
So all of these companies are already exist. We've got Best Flow, EKU, IoTech, FHE, and of course, PFP, Premium Frac Pumps. And then we have ProFrac Manufacturing. So taking each of those entities and carving them out underneath our own Holdco, Manufacturing Co. is a focus that we have and making sure that we've got a good clean process that we don't kind of create too many issues for the accounting team. But basically going in and isolating that out so that all our stakeholders have the best view of how our business is actually put together and how to treat these different cash flows that exist within our umbrella. Along with that, then we also have the largest sand business in North America.
Really? Wow. I didn't realize that, right?
Certainly in the energy industry.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know how big these sand and aggregate businesses are, but we've got almost 23 million tons, and that's just dry capacity. Looking at the wet capacity at the wet plants, it's substantially higher than that. It's all in basin. And it's all geographically located as close to our customers as possible so that the last mile and the most expensive part in many situations is that last mile on the logistics. And so getting these as close to the wellhead is so very important. And we have the largest sand business in the industry. And
yeah, that's impressive. So what do you make of this trend toward the wet sand thing? I was at the frack, you know, conference earlier in the year in the Woodlands. And, you know, they had wet sand handling equipment there. I forget which company it was. But, I mean, there's definitely difficulties. I mean, it's not the same as dry sand. But, you know, having the most available sand, is that a good trend? Or how do you guys see that?
So we watch it really close. And we, of course, rocks. If you get rocks in your equipment, it's going to tear up all your pumps. It's going to be really, really expensive on the maintenance side. So making sure that you've got good, clean processes and finding that baseline of, you know, how much actual additional R&M expense is associated with this and what process is the best. Is there a process that's good enough to deliver us the same R&M that we get with dry sand?
I didn't think about that, but wet sand is just harder to work with to get out the larger pieces and all that stuff and to shake out or do whatever you got to do to it, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges, but I think that the industry has made a move in that direction. And, you know, what I'm just constantly surprised with the tolerance that operators have developed over the years, where historically it had to be northern white.
Yeah, exactly.
It had to be the size. It had to be this.
Remember when they did ceramic? Like, they would do the little beads, so it would be exactly the size you wanted, right? I mean, crazy.
And now it's just gone to a point to where some of them don't care what size it is. And now with wet sand, there's not really a size. It's just, you know, it's just sand. And whether or not there's rocks in it, it's just all about cost. And so over time, I don't know if anybody has enough data to really know if this is going to cause any degradation on well performance, or if this is going to mess with the chemistry downhole, causing any sort of, you know, organics or, you know, any scaling or H2S issues at some point. But
yeah, you would think that wet sand would be dragging some of that down there, some weird bacteria that was just growing on the surface, right? Instead of having it cleaned out. But hey, you guys got a fluid in business, so throw those big rocks in there. What do you care?
You know, when we first got into frac, we were just bricklayers. And when you'd build a school, you had a retainage. They'd retain 10% of your check until it went through a full inspection and everybody got to look at it. In some situations, the school district would have like the coach out there telling you whether or not your brickwork was good or bad. And you had to satisfy everybody before you could get your retainage back. And we moved into this business because, well, once you pump it down a hole, nobody knows what happened.
Right, yeah.
And so we're like, man, there's no retainage. And once it goes down there, there's no warranties. There's nothing. So it was like, man, this is awesome. And so now I think we're going through the tail end of that, where if they're actually doing something that hurts their well performance and that you're not a big fan of anyway, you know, it might be a while before they figure out that, you know, it's not a good thing. And I don't know if this is one of those situations or not, but
it's always been a weird thing for me in this business that, you know, the end user, the operator who's having the well drilled and fracked or whatever, that they don't, you know, that they would just go for the cheapest solution or whatever, because, you know, you have the lifetime of the asset, right? And, you know, you saw that in the early days of horizontal drilling. I mean, there were some wonky holes that went down there and nobody knows until they try to go put an ESP down there and it won't go through the hole because everything's wonky, right? So, I mean, if I was an operator, I would think I wouldn't want the lowest bidder on every job. I would want somebody who's going to give me a good quality well at the end, because I'm going to have that, right?
Certainly, certainly. And I think that the industry as a whole is just, the innovation is phenomenal. The quality of work, utilization rates, they just keep improving. This is a great industry to be a part of. And there's a lot of, we have a lot of great competitors out there that do great work. But, you know, going in and looking at changing techniques, there's a lot of people jumping up and down about the inventory, remaining inventory, and they're real quick to call rolling over of well performance. And I wonder how much of this stuff is changing techniques and just the overall pace of innovation, and how much development and innovation is in the wrong direction compared to, you know, are we actually running, you know, is this degradation or not?
Right.
I think we've got a long road ahead. I think it's going to be interesting to see how many different things we end up trying all the way through. But in the meantime, like, I'm going to sell a lot of wet sand, and we're probably the best people to buy the wet sand from, because we're concerned about our equipment because we pay for it. Right. You know, if we break it, it's on us.
On you, right? Yeah.
And so the quality of the wet sand is going to be above and beyond, because if it's not, then we'll be right there with the operator, you know, having our helping of pain.
Right. And I think that's interesting, because, I mean, just to wrap this up, man, we've kept you so long already, but the idea that really kind of separates ProFrac is that integration, right? Because now, you know, everybody's on the same team, basically, right? You're not going to get some, you know, shoddy fluid in or some bad sand to put down through your stuff, right? Because it was cheap and you were trying to save some money, because it's all part of your operation, and your relationship with the customer hinges on that, right?
Well, I mean, I think when you look at this overall space, it's a value chain.
Right.
And if any one participant in that value chain is benefiting disproportionately from the rest of the value chain, they get knocked off their perch pretty quick. And it doesn't matter if it's under one umbrella or if it's just across the industry, it's all part of the same pie. And if somebody's getting their slice of the pie is too big, it won't take long for it to be eroded away. the dysfunction and the conflict, everything, the knife fights that this industry is known for between customers and vendors. When you look at a vertically integrated business, all of those conflicts, the knife fights, everything that the industry is known for, nobody gets to see any of that.
Right.
Because it's
behind the curtain.
Behind the curtain.
Yeah.
But we go in and it's important to balance everything out so that you can keep the organization functioning together, being successful together, and that you're not passing on a problem that manifests its worst form with the next person in line, which is what you get when with a very fragmented value chain. The vertical integration means that we're making things, making products that need to last, that there's no planned obsolescence built into them so that I can sell another one quicker. And that we make very careful evaluations on product life and materials and balance the cost over the benefit and to try to measure and monitor everything and make sure that the wins and the losses are shared as evenly as possible where the knives come out. I think when you look across the cycle in any part of the oil and gas industry, you're going to see people that are, you know, companies that thrive and are hated for it. And they get taken off their perch pretty quick. And I think this industry is fast. It never stops. And it is an equalizer of pain. And so if anybody shines too bright, they'll be brought back. And our focus is, how do we take the entire value chain and we all rise together?
Excellent. Well, Matt, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And congratulations again on that cover for World Oil. That's a thing, right? That's a great deal. So I'm sure we'll have you back sometime in the future again, and we can talk about it maybe next time you start folding some companies in, you know.
There'll be more. I think getting these verticals set up the right way and, you know, on a relative basis, I think there'll be quite a few opportunities.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into our show. Please check out the show notes for the links we discussed in the podcast. We value your opinions, so if you have any questions or comments, kindly email them to us at deepdive@worldoil.com. Additionally, we'd appreciate it if you could rate us on your preferred podcast listening app. Lastly, don't forget to visit worldoil.com for the latest technical articles and news about the oil and gas industry.